This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I'm going to be talking about American Ultra, Sinister 2, Hitman, Agent 47, The End of the Tour, and Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the world famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can finally find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Straight Outta Compton last week didn't just do well. It did unprecedentedly well. It was, I believe, the second highest grossing opening in August ever, after Guardians of the Galaxy was last year. And as great as Guardians of the Galaxy was, and much as I loved it, this was even more impressive for Straight Outta Compton because it's not 3D, and I don't think it was an IMAX release. I mean, you throw in ticket bumps and that sort of thing, and it's a lot closer in terms of tickets sold to Guardians of the Galaxy, although Guardians of the Galaxy still definitively beats it. It was at $60 million. The estimates went up and up and up. I remember last week, I am the one who said, guys, this movie's not just going to do in the low 40s. It's going to do in the 50s. It might even reach $60 million for the weekend, and it did. And I think the number was 47% African-American. And yes, that's high, but still, you had more than half of its audience was not African-American. That's a significant crossover hit. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the NWA and the associated artists with that were and are popular outside of their own limited demographic. I mean, this is not just a music that was listened to on the street corner in Compton. This was listened to everywhere. But what's interesting is the reaction that it got. I was on WLW in Cincinnati talking to both Mark Amazon and Bill Cunningham about this. But I know what's bothering some people, and certainly was bothering Bill, was the overwhelming negativity that comes from gangster rap music. And I'm not here to debate the political situation of police and any sort of tensions going on in the black community in LA or elsewhere. But whether you like it or not, whether you think it's inappropriate, and there's a song in there called F the Police, and we all know about that, and we all know the history behind that. But when an entire demographic overwhelmingly feels that they're being treated unfairly, you need to at least entertain the possibility that that demographic is being treated unfairly. I know a lot of people who saw this movie who are either African American or they agree with the fact that this is a disproportionate amount of policing. You can't just say, oh, you guys are overreacting. Because my experience has been when there is a portion of society that feels put upon, there's a good chance that there are some things going on there. And you can't just dismiss it as the majority of the population. So I think it opens up a lot of wounds. And one of the things I was asked is, does it address the modern issues? Does it address Ferguson and stuff like that? No, it doesn't. It doesn't have to. It addresses the Rodney King situation that happened in the 90s. And you can draw whatever comparisons you want to that. You can sit there and not like the F the Police song, and you cannot like gangster rap. But you cannot deny the fact that it is a popular form of music. And there's something to be gleaned from that if you're going to look at the situation and maybe try to fix the problems that are causing this. That's just a little bit of a sound off on some of the discussions I had post-release because it was so big and it was so huge and it wasn't just this niche movie. It's a phenomenon. In other news, there's a couple Star Wars things I want to note because Disney had their big convention this last week. One of the big announcements is Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World, is slated to direct Star Wars Episode 9. That was a no-duh situation. They go, hey, this guy on his second movie directed one of the biggest movies ever. I mean, I'm sure they thought of the same thing when they were trying to court Joss Whedon into doing this. And then there's people who think it's a terrible idea because they thought that Jurassic World was crap. Well, you can't ignore $600+ million on a weekend, especially when nobody expected that. The next piece of Star Wars news is just an interesting thing. They're going to be doing a Star Wars theme park in Disneyland, which I think is fantastic. I probably won't end up going because I don't have the money for that. Disney parks are so expensive. I got three kids, man. That's like a second mortgage on the house just to get in the door. But it sounds amazing. I'd love to go. Disney, you know, if you want me to do a review, give me a call. You've got my number. Another piece of news is Will Smith. This is in development news. He may not even be in the Bad Boy sequels. They've got parts 3 and 4 slated with release dates, and they don't even have the director and cast locked. Look, if Will Smith and Michael Bay, if neither of them come back, this is just another crappy Martin Lawrence movie. Would they do Black Knight or Big Mama's House sequels to the tune of hoping they'd be that successful? Also in development news, season 4 of Project Greenlight has been greenlit, and that's probably because we need more terrible independent movies, because all the Project Greenlight movies aren't very good. None of them are good. And finally, this little piece of thing, this cheeses me off. Hayley Atwell, who's best known for Agent Carter from the Marvel Universe, wants to be Doctor Who. She made it because somebody just offhand asked her if she could be a character in Doctor who should she be? She's like, well, I'd like to be, she says, I'd like to be Doctor Who, which shows she doesn't watch the show because he's the Doctor. And yeah, every now and then they credit him as Doctor Who, like in the 70s. He never goes by that name. He goes by the Doctor. So if you don't know who Doctor Who is, you shouldn't be saying you want to play Doctor Who. And of course, that kicked up another firestorm. Should a woman play Doctor Who? Well, first of all, it doesn't matter because Peter Capaldi's the Doctor now. He was the Doctor last season. He's the Doctor this season, starting in a couple weeks. And I just guess he's going to be the Doctor for the next many years. He might top Tom Baker for the run as the Doctor. And here's why. He doesn't have anywhere more he really wants to go. He's kind of knocked around as a character actor for 20, 30 years. He's not at the beginning of his career. He's in a solid geek-driven show with a huge fan base. Why would he go anywhere? So, I mean, we may not be able to get rid of Peter Capaldi for another 10 years. Who knows? Can a woman play the Doctor? Absolutely. It's like the whole Black James Bond discussion. And then for those who don't know, you can have the Doctor regenerate into a woman. It's been done before. The Master has regenerated into a woman. Matt Smith, the 11th Doctor, referenced another Time Lord who switched sexes a couple times. So this is nothing new to the Doctor Who mythos. So, yes. But, like I said, just like I don't want just any black guy playing James Bond, I don't mind a black James Bond like Idris Elba. I wouldn't mind a reasonable choice as the Doctor for a woman, but just not Hayley Atwell wouldn't work. Yeah, she's got great breasts and she's a good actor, but I don't think she's the Doctor material. I mean, you want to go back to the black Doctor Who idea? Give me Richard Ayoade. I'd totally go for him. I think he'd be a great Doctor. But again, we got to wait till Peter Capaldi does his run, and Hayley Atwell might be 50 by that time that happens. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Couple real quick ones. First of all, Victor Frankenstein opens on November 25th.
Igor, you and I
shall be at the very heart of a scientific enterprise that will change the world.
We shall create a life out of death.
It's alive.
Do you realize how significant this is?
Oh, I have an inkling.
Are you not afraid to challenge the natural order,
Mr. Frankenstein?
No.
And it's Frankenstein.
I get a kick out of the fact that they actually make a Frankenstein joke in this. It's from 20th Century Fox, which it's this weird string of events where they make a joke that references essentially Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein, which is a 20th Century Fox film. And then you have to think, well, why isn't this Universal? I thought Universal was rebooting because they did Dracula Untold last year. This is just a Frankenstein adaptation. It looks like they're trying to go a little tongue-in-cheek with some of these scenes. As long as it's a decent Frankenstein movie, I'm okay. The next one I want to hit real quick is Ride Along 2, which opens on January 15th.
Your partner is marrying your sister. Good cop, sex cop.
All the new dealers in Atlanta are getting supplied through Antonio Pope in Miami. You need to get me something on this guy.
2 days tops. So get a team together and fix this.
Miami, James, I'm going. Let's get
ridiculous. The brothers-in-law just got to town.
You say that again, I'm gonna shoot you in the face.
Ironically, we're talking about Ride Along 2 in the wake of Straight Outta Compton with their song F the Police by Ice Cube, and we're talking about a movie where he's going to be playing a cop. I wish they got that music as the music for the movie. This looks like it could be a bad comedy sequel. It looks like they've increased the number of characters, which that might not be good. I like Ken Jeong, and I like Olivia Munn. I don't know if you need them in this movie, because wasn't the first one all about the chemistry between Ice Cube and Kevin Hart? And you add more people in the mix, it may not work. So who knows? This could be the beginning of the not-so-good year for Universal. because this year's been good for the next 3 years. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hitman, Agent 47, and Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the movie reviews. Let's start things off with a killer movie, Hitman, Agent 47. A woman is targeted by a genetically engineered hitman only to discover they share a lethal secret.
You know why you're still alive? Because I chose not to kill you. But they will.
Do you remember the day they took you?
We were part of the same program.
They want what's inside our DNA.
The speed. The intelligence. The strength.
Now, many of you may not remember, but there was a movie called Hitman about 7 or 8 years ago. It starred Timothy Oliphant, who I think is really cool, and he can play a bad dude, like in Justified or some of the other films he's been in. But that movie was not very good. The first Hitman was ridiculous. It's based on a video game, and I'm sure the video game's fun. It's popular, obviously. Part of the problem with the first Hitman is he was supposed to be this great hitman. He was the most obvious hitman ever. He was this weirdly, completely bald guy with a barcode on his back walking around in a tight black suit and a red tie with guns. He stood out like a sore thumb. Now, this one, it's the same look, but for some reason, this guy pulls it off much, much better. And I like Oliphant. I think Oliphant's a good actor, but he really was not very good in the first Hitman. This one, they've replaced him with Rupert Friend, which is such a nice name. Friend. He is best known for doing stuff like Pride and Prejudice and The Boy in the Striped Pajamas and the Young Victoria. He comes from a much more award film driven base. And so doing Hitman Agent 47 seems a little bit, I guess, below him. But you know what? He does a great job in it. He comes across as the character of this cold, emotionless killer who has just a shred of conscience and trying to do the right thing. He does a great job. And Hannah Ware plays the woman who's running with him, and she does a good job. Now, there's a lot of similar stuff we've seen in this movie. You've seen stuff in movies like Wanted and, of course, the other Hitman. And just watching the film, it looks like something that you would have caught on like Showtime, not the Skinemax version, not the sex version. It's just a sort of this European action movie, and it works. It lays it on a bit thick with the action, and the stars aren't that great outside of Friend as the hitman. But overall, the movie works for what it is. You got to see a film and understand what it is. I would not spend full price to go check this movie out. This is the kind of movie that if you catch it on demand on Netflix or you rent it one night and you're sitting at home and you got nothing better to do, it's fine for what it is. It works. It doesn't feel like a big movie, which is why it's coming out in August. It has big action set pieces. And the story's kind of pointless, too. In one of these action movies, the story just exists to propel the characters through these action set pieces. And that doesn't work well. I mean, honestly, you know, Mission Impossible was the same way. Actually, this one also has the bad guys are the Syndicate. So it's weirdly sharing a lot of connective tissue with the Mission Impossible movies. But it works. It's fun. I enjoyed it. I actually had a good time watching this film. I was surprised at how much I did. I had to go see these three films in a row as a triple feature on opening night because one of them was American Ultra, which I actually had something stop me from seeing the screening. The other two weren't screened for me. So I was watching this. This was the last in a triple feature. And you know what? It kept my interest. I was getting tired because I'd been in the movie theater for 4.5 hours by the time this movie was winding down. But it was an entertaining film. And there's slow parts, but overall, kind of like if you just want mindless entertainment on a matinee, check out Hitman Agent 47. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. Based on the international bestseller, this animated film adapts a variety of essays told by a political prisoner being released after 12 years.
My name's Mustafa.
What's yours?
We will escort you to your port of immigration.
I'm gonna miss him too.
Look, it's the poet!
Mustafa?
Is he free?
You bring a riot to our doorstep.
Where are you taking him?
Nothing less than a call to rebellion.
They think I'm their prisoner, but I've flown away many times.
While I've heard of The Prophet, the book by Khalil Gibran, I've never read it. I'll admit that, fully admit that. There's a lot of books I haven't read, and it's not that I'm not terribly well read, especially with the classics. But boy, the early Stephen King bibliography I'm good at. This movie would not have been what I would have pegged an animated film to be. It's produced by GK Kids, which is a little more of an artistic label, so to speak, for kids programming. They did movies like Ernest and Celestine, which came out last year, I think, or the year before. It was up for an Oscar about the mouse and the bear having an unlikely friendship. It's sort of like the European version of Studio Ghibli, where they don't just do fluffy kids movies. Don't see this as an animated film and say, oh, it's going to be like Minions. I'm going to take my 5-year-old. This is a lot more to it. And I guess I've not read The Prophet, but as I understand what it's about a political prisoner who's under house arrest for 12 years. It's a series of essays. There's something like 20 some essays about the human condition. And in the movie, it's him telling these essays and poems to other people. In the movie, it frames it around this little girl who's mute. They have no reason for her being mute, but she is. And her mother is the housekeeper. And he sort of befriends the little girl. And he's voiced by Liam Neeson. The housekeeper is voiced by Salma Hayek for the English language version. And Quvenzhané Wallace plays the mute girl who just doesn't actually have real dialogue. They're sort of trying to evade the authorities because they don't want him put away again, like in a full prison, because they're in the Middle East. I think it's an unnamed country, but the authors, I believe, Lebanese. And so it's somewhere in the Middle East, and they're afraid he's going to be put in jail for longer because his stories and poems and essays will incite a rebellion. What they did is they set up the framework, which is where the traditional animated story comes from, and that's where it does feel kind of Studio Ghibli-ish. But then it goes into these, essentially the essays. They don't do all 26, I don't think, but they do a bunch of them. And then ultimately, it sort of reminds me a little bit of The Nutcracker, if you've ever seen the stage production, where it has this opening explanation of the story, and then like the second act is all just sort of musical numbers from around the world. And that's what this is. These are a bunch of essentially music videos directed by different animation directors and assembled together. So you get different styles and different approaches. And a lot of them are put to music or song. And it becomes very abstract. It's not really a traditional narrative. Kids can see it and appreciate it, but the kid can't be expecting this stuff to be spoon-fed to them. And I've said this before about something like Shaun the Sheep. Although Shaun the Sheep is as abstract and sort of out of the box as Shaun the Sheep was, this one leaves it in the dust. It's a really neat movie, and it's actually worth watching a couple times. So, you know, check it out when it comes on DVD. But I'm going to have to say that Khalil Gibran's The Prophet rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about American Ultra and Sinister 2.
Because we can!
Uh-oh.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Keikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about American Ultra. This was actually the first in my line of triple feature movies that I saw on opening night. I did not see the screening for this. Circumstances kind of beyond my control intervened. So this is not a knock on the studio, because the studio did screen it, and good for them. In American Ultra, a stoner goes all Jason Bourne on a group of attackers and discovers that he has a secret past that he has forgotten about.
Hey, I just killed two people.
That's awesome.
They had guns and knives and...
Did you call the cops?
No, I didn't call the police because I have like a lot of weed and like mushrooms in my car.
Agent Hal has been activated. He killed two operatives with a spoon, sir.
A spoon? What?
We're terminating Asset Hal.
Why are there men in hazmat suits?
Thanks to your actions, two CIA assets are dead. Did you just hang up on me?
Something very weird is happening to me. I keep killing people. There's a chance I may be a robot.
You are not a robot.
I am not a fan of stoner movies. And so when I first saw stuff about American Ultra, it immediately turned me off. I'm not into stoner comedies. I mean, some of them are okay, like the really good ones. I think Harold and Kumar is pretty funny. I think one or two of the Cheech and Chong movies are mildly entertaining. Dude Wears My Car is funny. Some of these I find okay because they're just funny buffoonery. Generally, though, I'm not a big fan of stoner or weed movies. I don't partake. It's not a thing I do. I'm outside of that culture, so it's not something I'm interested in. So when I saw all the posters for American Ultra, I was completely disinterested in it because it looks like an absolute stoner weed movie. And finally, when you watch the trailer, it gives you a little bit more of this whole CIA connection and people are coming after him and what's his history and his past. So I think this movie is ultimately going to be mismarketed. The studio even sent me stuff. They sent me like a burlap bag with like, I mean, stuff to put your weed in, essentially. And that's not what the movie's about. Yes, he's a stoner, but it's him on the run trying to find out what his past is, and these bad guys are coming after him. It's got an interesting objective, and it's got an interesting setup. And I gotta say, both Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart do fine jobs in this movie, simply because they're two actors who are struggling to overcome their own typecasting by their limited ability to act as different characters than just what you see on screen. Pretty much every Kristen Stewart character is a version of Bella from Twilight. Pretty much every Jesse Eisenberg character is a version of Mark Zuckerberg from The Social Network. They both struggle against it, and I think they do well enough with those roles, and they're different enough that it didn't annoy me. The bad guy in this, though, is Topher Grace. And I don't know why people keep casting Topher Grace as the bad guy. I mean, if you recall, he was Venom in Spider-Man 3. He's Eric Foreman. He's another one who kind of can't work outside of previous roles. Everything he plays is a version of Eric Foreman. Even as this hardcore jerk of a CIA agent, he's still Eric Foreman. If Eric Foreman worked for the CIA after leaving town in the 70s. Connie Britton plays one of the handlers, and she's actually pretty good in it. I think she does a good job, and so there's some other decent performances. This is the kind of movie very similar to Hitman Agent 47. If you catch it on the weekend on demand or you rent it or you catch it on HBO, you're not going to really waste your time. This doesn't hold together. I think of all these movies, Hitman was my favorite of the three I saw. American Ultra is like just good enough to go see, but don't go full price, you know, matinee or dollar theater or get it on Redbox or stream it. And when it comes to video, it's not a fantastic movie. It has some very funny moments. It has some very clever moments, but there are giant gaps and holes in the writing where the movie almost completely falls apart. And it does it on multiple occasions. And that's why it just doesn't work as well as it could. And considering how many people they have
behind this movie, you could have put something better together. And as much as I did find it entertaining, it also was, like most things, an imperfect movie. Very typical of what you'd expect from a mid-August release as we're leading into school and people aren't spending as much time in the movie theaters. So ultimately, I'm going to have to say American Ultra kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Sinister 2. The evil demon Bagul is back, trying to corrupt a child into committing murder.
I'm worried about Dylan.
Why?
He's just different.
I have something to show you.
There are references to Bagul across all cultures. Some believe that it fed off of the corruption of innocence. There are always three things in common. There's a murdered family, a house, and some form of offering.
I was very pleasantly surprised by the first Sinister. And the studio actually sent me the DVD of the original Sinister. Just says, hey, watch this one before you see the next one, which was kind of cool because I got a chance to revisit it. I showed my kids, scared the crap out of them. This movie reminds me a lot of Insidious 2 and sort of my feelings on Insidious 2. The first Insidious was brilliant. It was a brilliantly constructed, in-deep ghost story. Extremely well done. The second movie tried to extend the story, and it made some choices that didn't quite work. And there are some that I thought were very, very bold. In Insidious 2, one of them was one of the big scary set pieces, one of the big scary moments takes place in an overly bright room. And I thought that was a bold choice because everyone shoots horror movies in the dark. I thought it was neat that James Wan tried that. In this movie, there are some choices made in this sequel that don't pan out. The story is about Deputy So-and-so from the first movie is trying to burn down all the houses that this Bagul character manifests in. And that way to break the chain so it doesn't continue killing families. And he stumbles upon this people basically, well, they're kind of squatting with permission in a house that has a Bagul infestation, so to speak. And it's a mother and her two sons, and she's trying to hide from her husband, and he's coming after her for the custody of the kids. And the kids are the ones that are being targeted by Bagul, but they tell it from the one kid's point of view who's being lured into this. If you watch the first movie, it's not told from the kid's point of view. It's told from the father's point of view as he's piecing all these murders together. And so it's a little bit of a murder mystery that turns into this demonic ghost story. Whereas this one, you already know who Bagul is. You already know that he's trying to corrupt children. And in this film, about half of it or a good third of it is told from the one kid's point of view as he's being courted by these ghosts of these kids trying to get him into Bagul's clutches. And that's a bold choice. And that's a neat idea. It doesn't quite work. And I don't know exactly why it doesn't work. It might be just the kids aren't really good actors. It might be how they shoot them. They just don't seem scary or authentically ghostly. It seemed like a good idea, but it didn't quite work. Also, the movie tends to go a little overly graphic, and I'm all for R-rated graphic horror movies. I mean, I'm not one of these people who think they need to be banned. It's rated R, for crying out loud. And now they'll say, why is it rated R? Grisly, violent images involving families and kids. So that doesn't bother me. But it seems almost too ridiculous at times. Sort of how the Saw movies, the original Saw movie was clever. And by the time they got to the sixth or seventh movie, the devices were so out of control, Rube Goldberg type things that didn't quite make sense. And while this doesn't reach that level, I imagine if they did six or seven of these, they'd be very elaborate. It's not just murders happening. They're elaborate, painstakingly planned murders that seem almost unrealistic. So I think that's the stumbling block. And then the other big stumbling block is the movie's trying to be a horror movie, but it's also trying to be this domestic story because that's the whole purpose of keeping these people in this house. And so the father can come after them. They have this weird domestic story that I really don't care about. I mean, Shannon Sossaman plays the mother and she's fine for what it is. I haven't seen her in a movie in a while, but it's exactly what it seems like. And that's an excuse to propel the story. So in the end, Sinister 2 is really not worth seeing. I mean, if you're a horror fan, check it out. It's better than the reviews are saying. I mean, it's like got a 6% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's better than 6% good. But it's still, I have to say that it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, we'll do the final movie, which is the end of the tour. We'll also do box office and, of course, the world famous DVD roundup.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finalizing your life and the show for the weekend of all the movies you want to check out this week in cinemas. It's August, but there's still some selections out there, and of course you got all the good stuff from July and probably some stuff still from June knocking around the theaters. But if you want to check out something new, it's out in limited release, so it's coming from city to city in different places. The End of the Tour. Ironically, another movie starring Jesse Eisenberg. After making a huge splash in the literary world, David Foster Wallace is interviewed by a Rolling Stone writer in the final days of his book tour.
What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country, that sort of thing.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No, I'm okay. How are you?
Because I'm terrified.
Hey, isn't it reassuring to have a lot of people read you?
I think if the book is about anything,
yeah,
it's about the question of why. Why am I doing it? And what's so American about what I'm doing?
If they're responding to your work and your work is really personal, then reading you is another way of meeting you, isn't that right?
That's so good.
Thank you.
Like I said, what's weird about this one and just the release date is it's finally trickling into flyover country. And that is Jesse Eisenberg is in this movie. He plays David Lipsky, who interviews David Foster Wallace. And he has America Ultra out this week. How long have we gone without a Jesse Eisenberg movie? And suddenly there's two within a couple weeks of themselves. What's odd about this movie, and I may be showing my Luddite roots here. I didn't know this guy was a real guy. Yeah, does that make me look non-intellectual? True, but me sitting here shirtless in lounge pants also makes me look like a non-intellectual. So I'm kind of used to that by now. What's interesting is I was trying to break into writing books and novels, which is very tough to do in the 90s. The 90s was a weird time because there was this impending internet that was just taking off. And then 10 years later, the entire crash of the publishing industry. But you're struggling through these literary journals. And I'm not a literary writer, and I never have been. I got a couple things published in science fiction magazines, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do pulp fiction, but pulp fiction magazines didn't exist anymore. Not like they did back, gosh, when my dad was a kid. You know, the days of weird tales and amazing stories when they were actually quality pulp fiction were gone. I mean, once the new wave came in the 60s and 70s, that kind of over-intellectualized science fiction and some of the stuff just wasn't entertaining to read. Now, David Foster Wallace published his book called Infinite Jest, and I didn't even know this book existed when I saw this movie. And they talk about how it was the most celebrated book and he's the most talked about writer at the time, and it was the mid-90s. I'm like, what about Stephen King? They talk about it as if there's never been a writer this big. Well, Stephen King, he was big like that in the 80s and through into the 90s. And it wasn't until mid to late 90s that he really kind of waned. But I looked up and apparently Infinite Jest over its entire life, over the last 20 years, it's like sold 150,000 copies, which isn't that much. I mean, it's a lot. Don't get me wrong. 150,000 copies of a book is a lot to sell. But it's hardly massive New York Times bestseller material. 150,000, that's over the course of 10 years, it's 15,000 copies. Over the course of 20 years, that's like 7,500 copies a year. That's not much for like the most celebrated writer of the 20th century. So I think part of my problem with this movie was there's a lot of navel-gazing happening in it. It's by people who adored Infinite Jest and then kind of wanted to build him up as this celebrity and then tear him down as a person in this sort of awkward interpersonal exchange. And that works, and it's a really interesting character study. And it does deal with a lot of topics like celebrityism and idolizing and are your mistakes good enough? It deals with a lot of that. And that's interesting. But there's a lot of David Foster Wallace worship going on in this movie. Khalil Gibran's The Prophet is I've heard of that. I haven't heard of Infinite Jest. So maybe that's just I'm an idiot. That's very possible. I mean, look, that's an excuse I make on many occasions. Let's put it this way. If you know who David Foster Wallace was, you'll probably love the movie. It works. It's exactly what you'd want to see. If you've read Infinite Jest and thought it was great, you will probably love this movie. If you've read David Lipsky's profile on him in Rolling Stones, you'll probably love this movie. If you don't know anything, there's still a lot you can get out of it. Now, Jason Segel, who plays Wallace, he does a really good job. And the reason it's not even that his acting is brilliant, but it's that he's so different than what he normally does. Segel's one of those people who kind of plays a role. And everything he's in, he's essentially Marshall from How I Met Your Mother. A different version. He was that in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. He basically played that in The Muppets. Anytime you see him in a movie, that's kind of who he plays. But in this one, he plays something decidedly different. Jesse Eisenberg does a good job, but he's still sort of trying to break out of his smarmy, snotty character he played in The Social Network. That's a struggle for him, and that's always going to be a struggle for him, because I don't know if he's got the range to play anything beyond that character. But overall, I'm going to have to say that the end of the tour, it just kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office real quick. The big winner was Straight Outta Compton. I said $55 million, and it actually made $60 million. That's impressive. That is huge. The next big release was The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which made $13.5 million, which wasn't very good. I don't know what happened there. I think part of it is I don't think Henry Cavill's a movie star yet. Yeah, he's Superman, but I don't think people see him as a movie star. They don't see, let's go see the new Henry Cavill movie. I certainly know they're not saying that about Armie Hammer. This was a movie that could have done better with some real movie stars. Maybe in a couple years after Henry Cavill has been solidified as Superman. But right now, he's still just the guy who played that Superman character once. And then a bunch of other movies you've never heard of. Or you may have heard of, but you don't remember. You may have actually seen. You may have seen Immortals, but not remember the fact that Henry Cavill was the star. Then I said Fantastic Four. I actually said it was going to drop over 70%. It just dropped 68%. It still just made barely over $8 million. It's at $42 million. It made in 2 weeks what the studio was hoping against hope it would make in one. This movie is crashing and burning, and I think there's going to be a huge come-to-Jesus meeting waiting if Deadpool does not click in February. Now, this weekend, I think Straight Outta Compton is going to repeat. I think it's going to get about $30 million. I think a 50% drop is fair. It might even have a smaller drop. Like I said, it transcends the demographic that people would initially think it would go for. And people calling for a banning of this music, I get really nervous whenever somebody's saying, you should not be allowed to release this song or release this movie. But you know what? You might be next. You might be off the air. I say some things on the show that's insulting. I don't want to be kicked off the air because of that. Now, if I'm insensitive and like my advertisers have an issue with me, that's different. But if I take a stand one way or the other on something, or if I say something that's unpopular, I railed against the feminists because of how they treated Joss Whedon with the second Avengers movie. I don't want to be kicked off the air because of that. And by the government telling me I shouldn't do it. The police coming in and saying, you should not be allowed on the air. I mean, if my affiliates want to kick me off, that's their prerogative. But the government coming in and sending the police and saying, you can't say this. That's a dangerous, slippery slope to go down. And I think that that's something people got to worry about when you're condemning a movie like Straight Outta Compton. That's obviously touching people. And I also pointed out, you know, if you look at this movie, the guys in this movie, while some of them were thugs and there were some drug deals going on, just because they rapped about it doesn't mean they did it any more than Johnny Cash spent time in Folsom Prison, aside from the time he spent on the stage. There's entertainment, there's image, and then there's reality. And you should not be held accountable on a legal level for your image. You should be held accountable for your actions and your deeds. So yeah, I think Straight Outta Compton is going to make $30 million again this weekend. It's going to crush the other three new movies in the box office. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. It's actually kind of a slow week for features. And this one's actually not a feature, but it's kind of like a feature release. Walt Disney has a collection of their short films.
the recent ones. Because one of the neat things Disney does is they'll drop a short film in front of a lot of movies. Not just Pixar does it. I remember they did this. They had a little short film in front of Raising Helen, a little cartoon. And they're cute and they're charming. And I remember they had Frozen Fever and they dropped it in front of Cinderella. Well, you get all of those movies in this collection. And it's a great collection. This reminds me a lot of the Pixar short film collections, which are fantastic. And I have rarely seen a Disney short film that I haven't liked. Then they got stuff like the one where they have the 3D and they're coming out. It's like, what about a horse? And then there's, of course, Paper Man, which is beautiful. Feast. They have some great short films. If you love short films, check this out. It's great. Yeah, yeah, they're scattered among all the other Disney releases, but you got them all in one spot. Also, Hackers, the movie from 1995, has got its 20th anniversary Blu-ray release. This movie looks fantastic. It's a complete nonsense movie because it's what Hollywood thought hackers were in 1995, which are ridiculous. They took all these levels of subcultures and crammed them into one, and really they were just a bunch of fat guys in their mom's basement clicking on a green and white screen. Hacking was not as sexy as it is in this movie, and Hollywood always tries to make it sexier with movies like Swordfish, or even this year they did Black Hat. They tried to make, oh, it looks so cool, it's hacking. Hacking's very boring. But it's a fun movie. It's really hilarious hearing some of the technology. Like, oh, look, he's got a 28.8 baud modem. So, but that's fun. It's a good movie. It's worth checking out. It's fun for that weird 90s popcorn sugary fun movie. And then from ABC Television, you've got Once Upon a Time Season 4 is available on DVD and Blu-ray, as is Grey's Anatomy Season 11. I've given up on the show, but it's still going. All right. That is it for this week. Join me next week when I'm going to be talking about No Escape and We Are Your Friends. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.